you are.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Apartheid, genocide, war. They end with sorrow and a cheer. But what happens once the celebration ends? Delegates to the Women Waging Peace Colloquium at Harvard University have been sharing ways to support social rebirth after trauma in countries like Bosnia, Rwanda, and South Africa. This hour, wisdom from women who have helped their own countries to recover and the lessons for Afghanistan after the Taliban. But first, the latest news from Afghanistan. Northern Alliance troops are patrolling the streets of Kabul, and pressure is mounting on the retreating Taliban. Earlier, I spoke with Scott Peterson, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in Kabul, and asked him to describe the mood on the streets there today.
Basically, there's been a huge sigh of relief in the city. Today, there was a lot of activity, a lot of action. People were out on the streets moving around. Shops were open. People were really in a jubilant mood still. I mean, you can come across, you can just come around and find on street corners people clapping. Sometimes, I mean, they're so grateful that that the Taliban has left them. And, you know, even today I spent time speaking to women, for example, on the streets. I mean, they're not throwing off their burqas yet or anything like that, but they felt free enough to speak about how their lives are going to be changing now and how these last 5 years have really been a dark period in their lives.
What kind of changes do Afghans on the streets of Kabul expect?
Well, for women especially, they're talking about the kind of things, you know, they're saying for the first time we're going to be able to make decisions about our own lives, our daughters are going to be able to go to school. I mean, the kind of lives they lived under the Taliban were something very, very oppressive. I mean, for example, the Taliban outlawed loud walking. If you can believe that. They outlawed kite flying. They outlawed all sorts of different things. In fact, I visited a hospital today. It's run by a Western relief agency, and they had set up some metal frames in order to be in compliance with the Taliban rules about segregating men and women. And so they had these metal frames. They were meant to be putting up sheets along all of those frames in order to separate this maternity ward, basically, because, of course, there would be women there, and from the rest of the hospital. So those are the kind of things that, you know, that are really beginning to come down now.
Scott, is the Northern Alliance communicating with the populace about its plans for the city and for the country?
Well, they are very much, and every time you hear a senior official speak, they speak about putting together a political coalition, one that is going to bring together all the ethnic groups in Afghanistan. They're certainly making all the right sounds. They're pressing all the right buttons, and the question is whether or not they can behave themselves sufficiently in the capital, Kabul, and elsewhere in the country regarding human rights, regarding other issues, so that they can win the trust, if you will, of the population here, because there's an awful lot of mistrust after what happened here in the early 1990s. Some of these same organizations and groups, ethnic minorities, were involved in a lot of killing here. Those are the people who've now swept into the city again yesterday, and they are, you know, people are still quite anxious about that.
What are the early signs? How are the Northern Alliance forces behaving, if you will?
Well, I came across an interesting situation today, and one that though it may not be standard throughout the country, is one that I think is partially illuminating about how attentive Northern Alliance soldiers are these days to human rights and maintaining human rights. Basically, I came across four Taliban prisoners who'd been captured yesterday morning. And the Northern Alliance soldiers there, two of these guys were wounded, the two of them had been shot. They were in a pretty bad state this morning, but basically they said that, first of all, they'd been saved by Northern Alliance soldiers from a mob in Kabul that was likely to kill them. We did see some of that going on yesterday. Anyway, so first of all, they were rescued. And then the second thing was that today, while that we were there, a vehicle arrived to take them to the hospital to seek medical treatment. Now, that doesn't mean that the Northern Alliance was handing them over to the hospital. And in fact, the commander who we spoke to, who sent them there, sent them with a note saying, please treat them on condition that we get them back. That was the note that he sent to the hospital. Now, these prisoners will be sent back, but it was just kind of a humane gesture that, and one that at least this commander said that senior officials and senior commanders had been hammering home this point that human rights was important to them. It was important to what the reputation of the Northern Alliance is here in Afghanistan. And so this was kind of an illuminating moment. I mean, that said, there have also been some atrocities. There are rumors that Northern Alliance forces in the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif have killed 300 people. And also there have been some summary executions that have been witnessed by independent witnesses during the event. So it's not, they aren't angels here, that's a fact, but they do seem to be cognizant of the need to put on a good human rights face.
At the political level, the forces, I think, continued to come into Kabul today, and the Northern Alliance leader himself came into Kabul, both in defiance of what the United States had earlier sought.
Well, that's right. There were more soldiers on the streets today, but they do keep a fairly low profile. I mean, they're not kind of beating their own drum, at least as I've seen in driving around the streets. I mean, usually you see a few soldiers here and there on traffic circles and at intersections. You see some foot patrols, and then you also see quite a few soldiers at what are military barracks and garrisons and things like that. So a lot of them have gone into those places just as the Taliban left them. These are the new boys in town, and so they're moving into those places.
And do people believe that they will make room for others to share power with them in a new government in Afghanistan?
Well, I think people are suspicious, and that's why it's so important that the Northern Alliance show that they are doing the right things from the very start, that they are in control of their troops, that the civilians, you know, that this is a unified front and not a group of warlords or factions, which really is what it is. It's an alliance. There used to be factions and warlords that were fighting each other in this alliance, and now they're all melded together, and you know, only time will tell probably whether or not they are able to maintain that unity, whether they're able to show the people here that they are able to lead.
Do people in Afghanistan have the feeling that the Taliban is completely on the run at this point, that they will be in the hills from every point, or are they expecting still some kind of significant conflict?
Well, I don't think anyone is expecting the Taliban to make much of a resurgence now. There are reports right at this moment that there is a very fluid situation in eastern Afghanistan, in Jalalabad. These aren't even Northern Alliance forces, apparently, which are causing the trouble for the Taliban, but apparently their own ethnic Pashtun, who are anti-Taliban forces, they have apparently risen up in Jalalabad and are causing huge problems for the Taliban there. And then in the south, in their stronghold, the word chaos has been used to describe what's going on there, where apparently people have been rising up as well. This was always something that was part of the U.S. strategy, was hoping that there would be Pashtun people who would rise up against the Taliban and against their oppressive rule. It didn't happen during 5 weeks of bombing. I mean, in fact, there were some real setbacks as some of those anti-Taliban Pashtun leaders were killed when they went into Afghanistan. But now it seems that that some of those efforts are bearing fruit.
That was Scott Peterson, a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us earlier today from Kabul. For the past 2 weeks, 60 women, peace builders from conflict areas around the world, have been meeting at the third annual Women Waging Peace Colloquium at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. One of the points of conversation has been how to establish transitional justice, systems designed to reestablish a sense of justice and shared values after traumatic experiences like apartheid, genocide, and war. What have we learned from past conflicts in countries like Rwanda and South Africa that we can apply to the current crisis in Afghanistan? And what role do women play in particular in rebuilding a country? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now in the studio are two delegates to the Women Waging Peace Colloquium. Major Rose Kabuye was the mayor of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, during the genocide of 1994. Also joining me in the studio is Sure Pile, a public interest lawyer in South Africa. She advises the South African Ministry of Justice on issues of equity and anti-discrimination law. Good evening to you both.
Good evening.
So we see in Kabul and around Afghanistan this, what appears to be this moment of radical transition, and the conflict could still be long. We don't know how it's going to play out. But clearly something is turning over here and turning over rapidly. You've both lived through big transitions in your own countries following apartheid, following genocide, and you've been thinking the last 2 weeks with women from all over the world about how justice can be brought into those settings and what needs to be done to bring people back to some kind of normalcy, to some kind of normal relations after there's been violence and death and hatred. Is it too early for people in Afghanistan, as fluid and uncertain as things remain, to begin thinking about how they can bring their lives into systems that will recognize what's happened and lay some kind of firmer groundwork in law, in understanding for the path ahead. Rose Kabuye from Rwanda, what do you think?
I just want to clarify one thing.
Please.
I wasn't the mayor of Kigali during genocide. I was the mayor of Kigali immediately after genocide.
Immediately after, all right, we understand. Yeah. Thank you. From 94 to 98, and I'm sorry for that confusion.
Okay, what I can say is that today in Kabul, maybe it's late because...
Already late?
No, it's not late.
Ah, yes.
What I mean is it's this time that they should start thinking of how they should go ahead. But basing on what we went through, we had had time to negotiate with the regime that conducted genocide. And so when we came to Kigali and stopped genocide, we already had a framework where to begin. But it doesn't mean that in Kabul they can't start. I think they should think of starting. Because it's during this time, I think after looking at the security issues, pacifying the whole country, that they should think of forming a government. Because I think it just took us 1 month to put a government in place.
In Kigali.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the government had to be a government that is inclusive, that is integrated, looking at all the particular groups that were in the country and the division that were in the country. So we put up a government where we felt that the people felt it was a government for them, not a particular faction. Because the RPF took power. RPF could have taken government and not included anybody. But RPF thought, what I mean RPF is Rwanda Patriotic Front.
It was Tutsi-dominated, but it included even Hutu in the new government.
It included even Hutu. Not only that, it included the parties that were in the country. So it was even describing how many people should come in and which people should come in.
Major Rose Kabuye, let me ask you. In Rwanda, you had the terrible backdrop of an enormous genocide, maybe 800,000 people killed. Afghanistan, by comparison, has had relatively little bloodshed.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's even easier for them to start thinking of what to do than for us, because we had gone through a terrible time. And it is that time that we thought, enough is enough. How can we go about it? And we didn't think of just taking the power, because it's not enough. Taking the power is one thing, but handling it and dealing with the problem is another.
It's not enough to take power.
Exactly. So they shouldn't just celebrate. They should think of what do we do after the celebrations.
I want to hear more stories from your experience, but Suri Pillai, let me pull you in. You saw the situation unfold in South Africa and the aftermath of apartheid there, where deep resentments had to be somehow worked out. We still have yet to see all the resentments brought forth in Afghanistan. It's just still in the sort of cloud of the fight and now the flight. But what do you think? Is it too early for them to begin reaching for understanding across those lines they've been cemented in for years now?
I think for as long as you've had oppression, you've had a violation of human rights, and for as long as you've had the kind of strong ethnic differences that have existed, it's never too early. It almost forms it's the basis on which you can go forward in a sense. But what I do believe in is I think that groundwork, the opportunity should not be lost in a sense, because the groundwork that needs to be covered now is going to be critical to what is seen as the period of transition. And that means a couple of things. I think, firstly, it means an issue of who comes to the table. And is that a representative? Is there clear representativity of everybody that comes to the table? And one of the things I think we as Women Waging Peace have also been talking about for the past 2 weeks, and from our own experience in South Africa, the whole issue of gender. How do you...
Gender, we're going to come right back to it. We have to take a short break. We're talking about transitional justice. Afghanistan is headed into a huge transition right now. We're talking with women who have been through the experience and have advice to share. You can join the conversation also. Can Afghanistan learn from the rebuilding of other societies? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back.
WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about justice in the transition from apartheid, from genocide, from war, to something more like normal life, to something like a healthy society and a healthy life. We're joined this evening by Major Rose Kabuye. She was mayor of Kigali in capital of Rwanda from 1994 to 1998. She's a former member of parliament in the Rwandan government, where she served as chairperson of the Security and Defense Committee. And by Suri Pillay. She's a public interest lawyer in South Africa, who is involved in advising on issues of equity and anti-discrimination to the South African Ministry of Justice. Suri Pillay, listeners, you can join us as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Are we getting any better at this? Decade by decade, crisis by crisis, are we learning? And what can we learn and apply in Afghanistan? Suri Pillay, just before the break, you were talking about the need, you know, and none of us are ignorant here of how complex this is and how real the issues are on the ground. There are all kinds of parties and tribal issues and international interests that are at play in Afghanistan right now. But still, perhaps there are some fundamentals that play out across national boundaries, across societies. You were talking about inclusion, the importance of real inclusion at the table as societies sort out these crises, and of gender inclusiveness. Speak to us about those.
I think women bring to the table a certain experience, which is what I'd say a sort of a certain a difference from when men were often making war and women were often making peace. I think that there's that aspect to that, and also a different negotiating style in a sense. But it's not just about a negotiation style. It's about real vested interest. And how do you include that voice that had for years been excluded in a sense? And I think in addition to that, you often have women who have often been the victims of war, oppression and conflict in many instances. But the ability of those women to transform what was essentially being a victim into being a survivor in essence. And that transformation process is incredibly powerful. And that ability to do that and then to place on the agenda, whether it's the political agenda, whether it's the international agenda, issues that go to real peacemaking in a sense. And I just want to come back to sort of the issue that you raised about whether is it too early to set up a transitional phase. I think in addition to who comes to the table is the question of what kinds of institutions of democracy do you put up to foster and to consolidate that democracy from transitional to the ultimate order that you want it to.
What's your advice to Afghanistan?
Well, I think in South Africa there was very much the issue with the Truth and Reconciliation, for example, was very clear in terms of the time frames. In terms of the objectives, I mean, first of all, it was a negotiated a settlement to get into the issue of trial.
And this was to expose the crimes that had taken place during apartheid, to get them on the table, to have people take responsibility.
Exactly. But also more than that, to bring to the national consciousness the issue of the horrific past, in a sense, and to institutionalize that memory. But more than that, to move on in terms of how do you reconcile and how do you say now let's move forward in a sense, and when do you bury the past to a large extent. I think those are some of the challenges in this, and the challenges not just for what's going on in Afghanistan, but also the challenges for America in a sense, and you know, where there's been a lot of victims and survivors. When do you move on, and how do you deal with reconciliation in that sense?
Clearly, there's still a large sense of grievance driving the American view of everything that's going on in this war on terror right now. I want to hear more stories from Rwanda, but let us bring a voice in from Afghanistan right now. We're joined by Rina Amiri. She's a senior research associate with the Women Waging Peace Initiative at Harvard. She immigrated as a child with her family 20 years ago as part of the first wave of Afghan refugees, and she's actively working with the Afghan community on finding peace out of the situation of war in Afghanistan. Welcome, Rina Amiri.
Thank you.
Rina Amiri, when you look at the situation in Kabul today, at the situation around Afghanistan, We hear talk about a political settlement. There's still huge questions about how the Northern Alliance will bring in other factions to sit at the table. But I wonder if, is this definition of who's going to sit at the table broad enough for you? Is it the kind of inclusive impulse that we hear Suri Pillay talking about here, or is it all going to be guys with guns?
I'm afraid, I think that's a really good question. One of the issues that I'm most concerned about is this marriage of convenience that often happens in situations of violent conflict that have gone on for several years, and the expectation that the spoilers have to be included at the government level.
Did you say the spoilers? What do you mean?
The spoilers. For example, between 89 and 92, when they were trying to create a transitional government in Afghanistan, members of the Mujahideen faction were brought together to create a new government, mm-hmm. after 92, rather. And it was not a process that went very well. In fact, the prime minister of Afghanistan started, Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, started shelling Afghanistan for over 2 years in order to consolidate his power. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a number of lessons to be learned from that experience.
Lay them out for us.
Excuse me?
Lay them out for us, please.
Well, one of them is that there are considerations of including the Northern Alliance or even members of the Taliban, we have to be aware that including those parties that have shed blood will significantly undermine the legitimacy of this new government.
But who hasn't shed blood in Afghanistan at this point?
That's the challenge. That one of the few figures that's being considered who has not shed blood in Afghanistan is the former King Zahir Shah, who is in Rome right now. But at this stage, the only role that he can really play is the role of a figurehead, as a ruler who brings in moral legitimacy. But I think we need to look more closely, to look at some of the perhaps more moderate forces whose voices have not been heard. And we shouldn't just limit our choices to the few people that have been waging war in one form or another in the last 20 years. And those are the names that are coming up these days.
But, Rina Amir, you must feel frustration over this. Here, gathered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you have these very experienced women who have been through these traumas, who have seen how justice and reconciliation can come out. Yet, where it's really happening, it's still guys with guns. How do you get from the hypothetical to the reality of women sitting at this table who have not been part of the action on the battlefield?
Well, I think we have to think about leadership at a number of different levels. Perhaps at this stage, women will not get the seats that they deserve at the government level in the way that we want. But there are other places that, in addition to continuing to put pressure to get women at the official government levels, is making sure that institutionally women are represented. For example, there is not a grassroots society in Afghanistan right now. At every level, Afghanistan has been destroyed. At the physical infrastructure as well as the social infrastructure has been destroyed. So a lot of resources hopefully will be coming into Afghanistan, and it's critical that women are the recipient of those benefits, and that that women who are leading NGOs right now in Pakistan are given some of those resources so that they could play a significant moderating force as part of the grassroots society.
Do you think with the Taliban being pushed aside at least somewhat that the odds of that actually happening are greater?
Absolutely. And the Northern Alliance has been approached by Afghan women leaders, both from the expatriate community and within the United States and in Pakistan in the past. And they have claimed that they are more sensitive to gender issues, that they're more inclusive. Now, I think, is when that is going to be tested. They have been quite receptive to a number of Afghan women who've actually gone and spoken to members of the Northern Alliance in the past. But their track record, while it's much better than the Taliban's, I think it's still questionable. And it will be very much, I think it's very important for the United States as well as the international community to continue pressing the Northern Alliance to be inclusive, not necessarily take just a gender approach, because I think that'll be problematic, but to make sure that when we're talking about representation, that every member of society is represented in some way. That should include all the different ethnic groups as well as the women.
We're talking about transitional justice as Afghanistan steps forward into what looks like a new future. How do old feuds get settled, and how do How does the international community help structure the process ahead so that it's not just the same old fighting and backsliding? You can join this conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What can Afghanistan learn from the rebuilding of other societies, and are we getting any better at this? Crisis by crisis, decade by decade, what are we learning? Rose Kabuye, I want to ask you, in the situation of Rwanda, I think women were in fact quite in evidence as the recovery took place there. Did you see any difference in gender roles there, and what was the cultural backdrop that helped determine the role that women played in the rebuilding, and what difference did it make?
During the Rwanda Patriotic Front struggle that combined other forces also from Rwanda that were in problems, women had a role to play. And so when RPF came to power and formed a government of national unity.
This is the Tutsi-led, essentially, government that came in after the genocide.
Yeah, and then formed a government of national unity,
yes,
according to Arusha Peace Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Women had a role. And so today we have 30% representation in parliament. We have 5 ministers. We have 5 permanent secretaries. We have women structures to empower them to have a say at the local council. Women have their own structures where they are elected, and the people that are elected have representation at all levels of decision-making up to parliament. So that way is a fact that with the government also felt that there's a need for women to be part of what is going on. We have also women are heading commissions, especially like the Unity and Reconciliation Commission headed by a woman, and she's really done programs geared to reconcile the people of Rwanda.
But with all that, can we really look to Rwanda as a model? You had a horrible situation there for a long time of enormous refugee communities across the border in the Congo, angry, doing hit-and-run attacks on Rwanda. Inside Rwanda, it's taken years to get people through into some kind of system of justice, with lots of folks sitting in schools turned into prisons for a long, long time. What can we take from Rwanda that we might positively use in Afghanistan as a lesson?
First of all, I talked about the government being inclusive.
Pull everyone in.
Pull everyone in. Secondly, put up some mechanism of uniting the people, and that's the Unity and Reconciliation Commission,
mm-hmm,
the Human Rights Commission, the Electoral Commission, the Decentralization and Democratization. So those are some of the mechanisms the government of Rwanda is putting in place to go past what we have gone through and achieve unity and reconciliation in the future for the Rwandan children. But also, when you go back to one big problem, justice, it's a big problem because, mm-hmm, now we have 100,000 people in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are waiting trials. Our justice system does not have the capacity to handle all the cases. And so we have now gone into our traditional system of resolving disputes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have introduced what's called gachacha. Gachacha is a traditional way where our grandfathers used to sit and solve disputes. We feel that it's the only way we can handle the cases that we have today, because we cannot be able to go through the normal conventional courts. We don't have the capacity.
So in a crisis, an older aspect of culture comes back to be helpful. Rina Amiri, what about that in Afghanistan? Are there cultural traditions that Afghanistan can draw on now to help make a government that's inclusive and to establish a sense of justice in a place that's been knocked around a lot?
Rose and I actually spend an extensive amount of time talking about this, and I've learned a tremendous amount from my colleagues at Women Waging Peace. And the gachacha concept is probably one of the most compelling pieces for me, because I do believe that we have to go back to rebuilding the traditional structures that we've had, resuscitating some of what we have had, which is we had elder counselors, councils, religious institutions, and those type of mechanisms are going to be critical to rebuilding Afghanistan. One mechanism that has been talked about a lot is the Loi Jirga, which is the Grand Assembly or the Peace Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
that has been used nationally whenever there has been a crisis of leadership or that there has been any type of conflict of a national proportion. You had the elders of all of the different tribes come together, and that is going to be that's going to have to be rebuilt. There is going to be certain challenges that we'll face in rebuilding that because some of those tribal leaders are no longer alive. There has been internal displacement, so the communities that existed 30 years ago are no longer there. There are also new players, so I think we're going to have to combine some of the old and the new. At this stage, Afghan society, after 30 years of war, has been utterly transformed. So we're going to have to find different mechanisms, and I think that there has to be a renewal at this stage, in addition to grounding it in our traditions, and there is a capacity for that.
Rina Amiri, I hear you thinking hard about this. At the same time, events on the ground are moving so fast. What confidence do you have that these kind of, you know, wonderful things will be integrated when the military picture is moving at such velocity?
I have as much confidence as the international community is willing to commit resources. In other words, I think it's rather alarming, actually, how quickly things are moving forward, because I don't think that the United Nations or the United States actually anticipated things to be moving as quickly as it has. I don't think the mechanisms have been thought through at this stage. People did anticipate that the Taliban would remain entrenched longer than this period.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, what will be absolutely critical is getting stability on the ground, and that'll require multinational forces and the ability of the United Nations and the United States to act very quickly and making that happen. All of those other pieces can be put into place, but the most critical element right now is establishing the safety of the people.
Do you think that Afghan women, we've just got another minute, but given how they've been pushed down during the Taliban years, do you think they're ready to step up and play an active role in this?
Absolutely, because despite the fact that they've been pushed down and pushed out of the public space, Afghan women have learned to be survivors in the last 30 years of war and have a tremendous resilience, just like the whole Afghan population actually has learned to, in some way, find a way to prevail in situations that are impossible to imagine for others. And they've had to do practical things like feed their families. They've had to be very creative in getting the resources that they need to do that. So I think going through that type of experience makes citizens even stronger. And Afghan people, I think, have had to be tremendously resourceful in the last 30 years, and we will certainly see a lot more of that. There are certain assumptions about how weak and powerless women are, and the women in Afghanistan have been powerless because the institutions have left them out.
We'll see if we can rebuild those. Rina Amiri, I've got to say goodbye to you now. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Rina Amiri is a former Afghan refugee and senior research associate at Women Waging Peace. We're talking with Major Rose Kabuyev from Rwanda and Surey Pillai about how to transition to justice after crisis and chaos. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back.
This is WBUR.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about transitional justice tonight, about the transition from chaos and war to a more civil society, about rebuilding societies after upheaval and crisis. We're joined by Major Rose Kabuye from Rwanda. She's a former member of parliament and former mayor of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, and by Surey Pillai, a public interest lawyer in South Africa. They've both been through the process that sits in front of Afghanistan now. What do you think? What can Afghanistan learn from the rebuilding of other societies? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jalay is on the line. Welcome, Jalay. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have a very practical question.
Okay.
How sustainable could peace really be if we keep 50.5% of the population of a country out of the peacemaking process?
And which 50.5% would that be, Jalay?
And that is the women. Men have traditionally waged war, and then they have been also the ones who have been solely responsible for participating in peacemaking. women are not part of war and not part of peace. Very often in these peace accords, you find the seeds of future wars. And it seems to me that unless women were instinctively and naturally peacemakers and preservers of civilization and future generations, if they are not an active part of this, no peace can be sustainable.
Jalay, let us put that to our guests, and thank you for your call. Sori Pillay, what about it? It is a fact that again and again we see men leading in war and then men leading in the formal peace. Yeah. In South Africa's example, in a situation, what was the role of women in particular, and did it make a particular difference?
Well, I think you'd almost see it in two different phases, in a sense. And the one would be pre-1994, which is prior to our elections, and with that goes sort of the two distinct phases, the phase during apartheid in which where women played a very significant role in the political struggle. And I think as political activists as such, it was sort of which prevails, is it the national liberation struggle, or is it the struggle for gender, or how does one incorporate both of that? And ideally, sort of what happened was in fact that kind of combination of incorporating that. And then one then got to the stage of the negotiating phase, and what was then done very significantly, and it was actually, in fact, was lots of tension and lots of conflict around what went in during that process when we were trying to get through to a constitutional, working through a constitution in itself and a constitution that will speak to all constituencies. And
did you feel that women were full players in that process in South Africa?
Women, I think, were significant players. They weren't full players, but they were significant players. But in addition to that, the political party, which was then the ANC, had actually introduced the quota system of about 33 1/3%, which should be mandatory for appointments of women, whether it was to political positions or other. And there was fierce debate around that. Lots of, some of the other parties didn't want this to happen, but eventually
guaranteeing women a third of the seats, in other words.
Exactly. And then after the period, we see and now we sort of see a significant participation of women at various levels. And I think answering to the question, I would say the way in which you bring those silent voices, excluding 50% of the population, is never going to sort of, you're never going to be ensured or guaranteed peace, in a sense, because it's just there's the whole group that's completely excluded.
But do you buy this premise that Jalay, our caller, puts forward, that if women are involved, peace is more likely? Do you accept that? I mean, are the interests so different if it's men dominating or women also? In there's still conflicts, there are still histories of war, of feuds, of interracial, intertribal rivalry. Does the presence of women at the table in the conversation change that?
Of course, I think, and the reason that I would say, of course, is because from the very basis of which women they socialize the children, they are the victims when they experience war in a different way. They often have to put the pieces together, and more often than not, as a policy maker, you have a different angle and a different the different issues that you bring into. And the one thing that I just want to give you an example of is the whole issue with making rape an international crime, in a sense. And it was very much something that was brought forward by the women's movement, in a sense, that was how does it become a war crime? And the extent to which it is, and women during times of war, and how rape is seen in that phase. And then just the last thing, I think that it's issue of sort of, so there's different levels in which you include these women that we often say have such silent voices, in a sense. The one is the whole process of education. I mean, where that starts from, that very level, they should have the right of access to education. The other issue is it's not enough to just refer to women as peacemakers, but they need to make that transgression. They need to be policymakers as well, and shift and be able to prioritize, not necessarily just according to women's needs, but according to society's needs. And I think that's the fundamental question around why, that their decisions at the end of the day is not going to be fundamentally different as decisions for men or decisions for women, but what makes it a better society at the end of the day.
Major Rose Kabuye, what about the role of the international community, of outside forces, as it were? If a society, and look at Afghanistan, it has hardly, at least recently, put women at the forefront. They've been really put in the back seat. If the society is not elevating women itself, can that really be imposed from outside? What do you think from your experience?
I don't think it would be imposed from our experience, because international community played no role in our transitional justice we're making today. It didn't play a role in helping Rwanda during the genocide. Mm-hmm. And it didn't even take part in what we are doing today. So, but I think it all depends on the people themselves and what they have to do. And maybe sometimes international community, especially during a transition, if they has to impose their own interest, it might become a problem. So I don't think really that international community can help, like, say, Afghanistan, to bring in the role of women. It's Afghanistan themselves who have to see the role that women are going to play in society rather than the international community.
That makes it sound like a tall order, but maybe there's a readiness there that we just haven't been able to see in recent years. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Sarah is on the line. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Mr. Ashcroft. A very important discussion. My main concern is that while I am a perfectly ordinary American, I don't feel powerless because I get to vote. Mm-hmm. I want to know if they've got a constitution. Does everybody get to vote, women as well as men? And this lady who just talked was very wonderful about the women's role and the need for it. But we've got to have everybody voting, and they're all at the borders, millions of them starving. We've got to feed them and get them home.
And get them into polling
and
booths.
And get them into polling booths, yes.
Well, that sounds like a good solution, Sarah. Let me put it to our guest. Suripile, have women always had the vote? Can women have power without the vote? Afghanistan has not had a strong democratic tradition. Even when there was democracy, I don't know off the top of my head whether women were voting or not. Surely they've got a long way to go right now. In your view, can women have a voice without a vote?
I mean, in South Africa, that was almost the the vast majority of South Africans never had the vote up until 1994. So when you go male or female. So when you go to a 65-year-old person and you see the joy in his face on the first time after 65 years being able to strike a ballot and sort of say, this is my choice, that is a fundamental decision as to, at the end of the day, who governs this country and also what kind of leadership he puts in place and what kind of life he chooses at the end of the day. So I think women, there can be no full participation without the vote. That is a critical precondition to what would be a constitutional democracy at the end of the day. But the other issue is, and I think that's another challenge for Afghanistan, is how they're going to get into the rewriting of the constitution or writing of the constitutional now such that it enshrines all of the values of dignity, of full participation, of rights, of all of the basic human rights, as is usually in a full bill of rights in a sense. And I think those are some of the challenges. Mm.
Rose, could you have the vote for women in Rwanda?
Yes, we do. We have had now, I told you, women structures. Mm-hmm. They have their own vote in their own structures, but that's just a way of empowering them to reach the decision-making.
That's interesting. But it's separate from the men's vote?
Separate from the men's vote, but also during normal elections, say at the mayor's elections, mm-hmm. women are part of it and they have a vote. But the women, through their own elections, then the ones that have been elected join at a council to sit with the mayor during the decision-making. So you see, it's a way of empowering more women to come in. So women in Rwanda have a vote. And we are now in a process of constitutional making. So we have a commission going through all the region of Rwanda to get views from all the people. And women have set up a committee to see how this constitution is going to be engendered. So this is an issue that is very important for women to have fully participation. They should also have a vote because that's one fundamental right.
It sounds like a long road in Afghanistan right now. We don't even have a constitution. They're not even sure how they're going to put the new the political factions together. And behind all that sits the issue of women. I thank you both for coming in tonight. It sounds like it's a hopeful message if it can get out there and if women there can act on it. Thank you very much to Major Rose Kabuye. She was mayor of Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, from 1994 to 1998. Thank you for joining us. And thank you, Sire Pile. Sire Pile is a public interest lawyer in South Africa involved in issues of equity and anti-discrimination with the South Africa Ministry of Justice. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Residents of Eragon, Oregon, have been aware of the dangers of chemical and biological weapons for years. That small coastal town houses the United States government's supply of nerve and mustard gas in igloo-like bunkers. Independent producer Nahani Rouse asked Eragon resident Roland Ingritson if the town's residents have received any public alerts about a threat to their town.
To my knowledge, there haven't been any, other than what Tom Brokaw has put on national news. You know, he showed our igloos sitting here, and he says, now this is where you want to maybe take out 10,000 people. So, you know, that kind of highlights our area. I mean, it was on our news that, you know, well, hey, look here, this is where you want to look. I mean, that had more ideas for somebody to do something than to somebody just flying over and seeing a bump in the ground, a bunch of bumps. So are we into the same category as California and their four bridges, or are we in the same category as Hanford and the other nuclear plants? I don't know. I hope we aren't. I'm a farmer and a welder. It takes two occupations in this country to make a living. And the life cycle has to go on. We've got to, you know, our next year's food has to be raised. And everything has to fall in place. You know, the equipment has to be repaired. Fertilizer has to be put on. I mean, it's just a day-to-day deal. Everything's still going on as if none of this ever happened. We're just trying to keep going. Yeah, you know, we come in and we watch the news. Well, okay, same things are going on. Or, you know, we're getting some progress here or some progress there. But day-to-day deals are still going on. We still have our auctions. You know, there's winter wheat being planted. We're sitting down getting things ready to go to the bank so we can borrow money and put our potatoes or onions or whatever crop we want to put in. We've got to come up with our next year's budget.
Roland Ingritson lives in Eragon, Oregon. We'd like to hear from you. Send your submissions for radio diaries by email. The address is special@wbur.org. Transcripts of the radio diaries featured on our special coverage are now available at the website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You've been listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.